2010အထွေထွေရွေးကောက်ပွဲရလဒ်ကိုချွင်းချက်မရှိအတိမတ်ပြုလက်ခံကြောင်းဥရောပသမဂ္ဂ EU နဲ့မြန်မာနိုင်ငံဆိုင်ရာပြင်သစ်တန်ယုံတို့ကစက်တင်ဘာလ15ရက်နေ့မှာကြာရောက်တဲ့အပြည်ပြည်ဆိုင်ရာဒီမိုကရေစီနေ့မှာထုတ်ပြန်ခဲ့ပါတယ
်မြန်မာနိုင်ငံကိုလေရင်လောင်စာစီတွေပို့ဆောင်ခြင်းအတွက်အာမခံဝန်ဆောင်မှုပေးနေတာကိုရပ်တန့်ဖို့ Britain အာမခံကုမ္ပဏီ5ခုကို Britain အခြေစိုက်မြန်မာအရေးလှုပ်ရှားတဲ့အဖွဲ့တစ်ခုဖြစ်တဲ့ Burma Campaign UK ကဧပြီလ20ရက်နေ့ကတောင်းဆိုလိုက်ပါတယ်
အင်ဆိုရဟာဘင်္ဂလားဒေ့ရှ်နိုင်ငံကရိုဟင်ဂျာဒုက္ခသည်တွေအတွက်ပေါင်သုံးသန်းအကူအညီပေးအပ်မယ်လို့စက်တင်ဘာလ12ရက်ကကြေညာထားပြီးမယ်အခုနှစ်မှာရိုဟင်ဂျာတွေအတွက်ပေးမဲ့အကူအညီစုစုပေါင်းပေါင် 16.9 သန်းပဲရှိမှာဖြစ်တဲ့အကြောင်းဒါဟာစစ်တပ်ကအာဏာမသိရင်2019-2020ဘဏ္ဍာနှစ်ကပေးခဲ့တဲ့အကူအညီပမာဏတက်85ရာခိုင်နှုန်းထိလျှော့ချလိုက်တာဖြစ်တယ်လို့ဗြိတိန်အခြေဆိုင် Burma Campaign UK ဖွဲ့ကထုတ်ပြန်ထားပါတယ်
You're listening to a special series from the Inside Myanmar podcast, where we're examining a quiet but deeply consequential move. The United States Treasury's Office of Foreign Asset Control, or OFAC, recently removed several Myanmar military-linked individuals and entities from its sanction list. These delistings have sparked urgent questions about accountability, the direction of U.S. foreign policy,and what message this sends both the military junta and democratic resistance. Regional arms trafficking, illicit finance, and rare earth mineral extractions are all on the rise with consequences that stretch far beyond Myanmar's borders. In this series, we're speaking with lawmakers, legal experts, human rights advocates, and voices from Myanmar's frontline struggle to unpack what happened, why it matters,And what comes next with that? Let's listen to the episode that follows.
Hi, this is E, your host for today's episode of the Inside Myanmar podcast. This episode is one of the episodes in the sanction series, and we're going to talk about the process of sanction and the cronies and allies of the regime that are put on the sanction and the nature and transparency of business in Myanmar as well. Today we are joined by Vicky Bowman. She's a former ambassador of the UK to Myanmar, and she's also director of Myanmar Center for Responsible Business, MCRB. Thank you for joining us, Vicky.
Thank you for inviting me, Mai.
For those who don't know, Vicky is actually fluent in Burmese, but for the sake of this interview, we're just going to stick to English. And also, she's also lived and worked in Mikalava and Jisu Demare. And then we're going to talk about the sanctions and all things diplomatic while she was an ambassador in Myanmar as well. But you were also appointed a companion of the Order of St. Michael and St. George, CMG, and received the honor at the Buckingham Palace in 2023 for your sustained and brave contribution to promoting human rights, democracy, and transparency in Myanmar. So we're really glad to have you on today's episode to talk about transparency of doing business in Myanmar as well. before doing all of that, I want to go back to your diplomat days in Myanmar. So, Vicky, you served as an ambassador to the UK in Myanmar from 2002 to 2006. And then before then, in 1992-1993, you were the second secretary in the embassy of UK in Myanmar. So let us go back to that time, 2002 to 2006. That's about 20 years ago. What's going on at the time? And Myanmar was under the rule of SPDC, State Peace and Development Council. And Aung San Suu Kyi was still arrested and imprisoned in 2003 onwards, I think, until 2010s. But she was briefly released in early 2002. So there's a lot of things going on. So what was the diplomatic nature of UK and Myanmar at that time?
So thank you. And first of all, just to reinforce, I'm not speaking on behalf of the UK government now. I'm speaking about my previous experience. So you're quite right. I was second secretary for 3 years immediately after the 1990 elections. And in those days, we didn't have these kind of sanctions. So what we're talking about now wasn't really relevant for that period. But in that intervening time before I came back as ambassador in 2002, the EU, of which the UK was at that time a part, had adopted sanctions on both individuals within the regime and also companies, economic enterprises. That happened in 1996, and those were sanctions which evolved in the coming years after that. In 1998, I think it was the first time that people were added to it for benefiting from the economic policies of the SPDC, or at least that was the phrase that was given. They also added people involved in tourism. And then later on, after I left, they added various sectors like metals, gems, wood, and that created a whole new set of sanctions. So back in my day, we were largely called upon to update lists of the current SPDC members, so the top military and ministers. We were doing that as part of a group of EU heads of mission. So in those days, within Yangon, we had the UK embassy, the Italian embassy, the French and the Germans, just those four embassies. And as EU heads of mission, we would be called upon to make recommendations to Brussels and to our own capitals, and then it would be up to the EU's Council of Ministers to decide what policy should be taken towards Myanmar, including who should be added to the sanctions list. So we provided information, we provided recommendations, but we didn't make the decisions ourselves. And what we were trying to do was get information in a very opaque environment. And it was opaque both in terms of senior military officials. Obviously, we knew the names of ministers, but we were also being asked to put family members' names on. So that meant wives, but it could also mean children. And generally, we had a lot of difficulty in finding that information. With family members, generally, you could get it perhaps from previous visa applications, but military people didn't travel to the EU, so there wasn't that much information around. In fact, probably the richest source of information tended to be in pagodas, because you would see the sort of donation plaques in some of the pagodas. For example, I remember in Pechimyang in Pinuluin, there were an awful lot of military names with all of their families. Later on, when in 2008, when sectors like metals and gems and wood were added on, I'm afraid, and I'm glad that I wasn't there at the time, that the embassy started to look in the yellow pages and was listing small businesses involved in furniture and jewellery, which I think was completely wrong. And it looks, frankly, kind of crazy. Yeah, that didn't go on, I think, for much longer. But what this overall shows is that we were dealing in an information opaque environment. There was a lack of up-to-date information. It wasn't accurate. I met someone a few years ago who told me that her father, who had been in the military, I think he was in procurement, had been added to the list in 1998, 3 months after he'd actually died in post. And that she had only discovered this because a company that she, by this stage, and this was during the sort of the democratic era, the company that she was doing business with, a European company, had done due diligence on her, discovered that and mentioned it to her. And she'd been unaware that her father had been on the EU sanctions list. So it was opaque both from the perspectives of those who were putting the list together, but also opaque from the perspective of those who were actually being impacted. And the heading around persons who benefit from economic policies, and you could sort of shorthand that as cronies, although I don't really like that word because I think it has so many different meanings. The nature of the information for that, there wasn't much. There wasn't much independent media reporting on business. There was Irrawaddy in terms of international. There was DVB, RFA, VOA, BBC. They didn't do much business reporting, though. And then there were the local business magazines like Dinar, Living Colour, GYA, and so on. But they tended not to report on individual companies, and they certainly weren't able to report critically on the behaviour of those businesses. So we had very limited information, and frankly, what there was wasn't really accurate half of the time, particularly in retrospect. We discovered that. And then on top of that, we as embassies didn't have much engagement with business people, partly because we weren't in the business of promoting trade relations. That was part of the overall EU and UK approach. We didn't have a commercial section. We didn't have those contacts. But also it was because businesses didn't want to engage with embassies. And that was, I think, because there was a perception that if they came to see embassies, they would be scrutinized by military intelligence. So they were scared to come. I remember one of them also saying to me, well, I'll come to one of your parties, but please don't talk to me about politics and human rights, because I only do business and that's nothing to do with human rights. Now, of course, 20 years on, this is what I work on, business and human rights. In those days, I didn't have a quick answer to say, well, actually, safety is a human rights issue and so on. Anyway, but it was more a reflection of the fact that, you know, the relations between embassies and businesses were very thin. And even when you were talking to businesses, there was going to be a risk that the views they gave you were very personalized and colored by their own experiences. So they weren't necessarily objective. So all of this means that, you know, from my recollection, what we really did when trying to decide who to put on this list of those who benefit from economic policies was we fell back on what was in the Global New Light of Myanmar around which large companies were giving donations when the SPDC was doing its various, you know, quote, good works, so building hospitals or disaster relief. So that ended up with a list, and I still have it somewhat kind of engraved on my brain, of KBZ Siachang, Shui Town Wai Tun, Zegabark in Shui, Yuzhan Atenient, Asia World, Stephen Law, Dagong Wei Aung, Shui Tan Winchor Win, and of course, Taser from Two Group. So that was the list that was there in 2003, including to some extent names of wives, names of children. But I guess overall, what I've discovered that the longer I've spent, the more I've realized we didn't know. And also the more I've realized that, for example, the making of donations is something which people do for a whole variety of different motivations. Some of them genuinely philanthropic, some of them because they are being strong-armed into it. But it's often the people who don't have to make those donations who are the ones who are probably benefiting most. So, for example, I was told that one of Fan Shui's relatives who had a concession for the Red Ruby cigarettes, you know, was making a huge amount of money out of that. But I never once saw her name appearing on a list. And I think there were others who over the years I sort of got to know about, people like PPT Company from Yates, so the sort of regional cronies. And then there were all those who had, you know, GEMS and Jade licenses who we barely knew. There was no transparency. And then someone used to say to me that, you know, the people who are really benefiting from some of these restrictions on things like fuel are the people smuggling in diesel from Korthang, and they're paying off, you know, the local navy or the local commanders or whatever. Very, very difficult to get those names. So the list that we ended up with was very subjective. It wasn't objective. It wasn't complete. It wasn't consistent. And, you know, having then tried over the years to meet some of the people that were on that list, it's become very clear to me there's a whole spectrum of behaviours, of morality, of the behaviour they were doing, both in business terms, but more generally of their attitudes. But yeah, as I feel, you know, in the end, it was a very subjective list and one where some of the information we received at the time wasn't actually necessarily correct.
I mean, that was way before the advanced internet search engines. So I imagine the finding the information in Myanmar at the time, it's not an easy feat.
To be honest, we had internet in the embassy. I mean, it certainly wasn't in Myanmar, but, you know, we could access a lot on the internet. But I don't think the internet would necessarily tell you, because the internet was just simply producing for you what others had written about them. You know, and particularly Irrawaddy being one source, and you know, some of the other media, and not all of that was accurate. So I don't think it was a lack of internet. I think it was a more a general issue of opacity, lack of freedom of expression, lack of sort of systemic information like company registries and so on, which came up later, and also you know, a tendency by all of these people to keep their head down and not be public. And you know, what I have sort of in going back and working as Myanmar Center for Responsible Business, what I've been trying to do is encourage companies to be transparent and to be factual, because if they're not, then they're leaving an information void into which others will fill that information gap accurately or not. The other thing that's changed is that whereas in those days, you know, 2003, we just came up with a list of names. But that process and the sanctions process more generally, not just on Myanmar, has been challenged a lot from a human rights and rule of law point of view around the need for much more reasoned evidence to be provided, including to the person being put on the sanctions list, because there was no information provided to that person. Indeed, although they were meant to, I think, be told they're on the list, they probably wouldn't have discovered that unless they'd gone and looked on the official journal. I'm not sure anyone was sending it to them. So there needs to be more of a reason for why they're put on lists, and there needs to be proper remedy and an appeals process. Another change that's happened is that under 18 children don't get included. And in fact, although there's been some legal processes around that, even our own foreign secretary at the time, our UK foreign secretary, Jack Straw, I remember him being very adamant that under 18 should not be included. But there were also subsequent cases of children, even if they were over the age of 18, challenging that case. And I'm talking to you here from Berlin. And I remember when we were having these discussions amongst the EU heads of mission, that the German ambassador got very animated about this whole question of family members. And I remember him saying that this is Sippenhaft. This is what the Nazis used to do. And this was this idea that, you know, the members of a family, the members of a clan, were shared responsibility for an act committed by, you know, the father or other members of that clan. And I've just come this morning from Sachsenhausen concentration camp, and there were people there. There was a German soldier deserted on the front line, and his wife, his two-year-old daughter, two brothers, a sister, and the brother-in-law were all arrested and executed in that Sachsenhausen camp in February 1943 for the so-called sin of their brother for deserting. So it's a Nazi practice to do this. And this is one, of course, which the Tatmadaw have been doing over the years, both in that period and now. So I think that's why some in the Myanmar context were arguing that this was precisely the reason why the EU should be doing it. But I do think that for others, and me included, we should be asking ourselves, should we be sinking to the same level as, you know, the Nazis or the Tatmadaw, or should we be much more kind of inspired by the Michelle Obama, you know, when they go low, we go high approach? I was thinking back on this. I had Kin Yun's sister-in-law, Kin Yun Shui's sister, came to see me for a visa. Well, not didn't come to see me, but applied for a visa to visit the UK. I think she had in-laws there because they were all kind of doctors. There were a lot of doctors in the UK. And when she came to collect her visa, because we didn't put her on a sanctions list, I asked her to come up and see me. And I said, look, we're giving you this visa, despite the fact that if the shoe was on the other foot, almost certainly you and your military intelligence brother-in-law would not do this. You know, we don't apply this kind of Sippenhaft approach, or at least we minimize it. And I also said that I was very concerned about her elder brother, who ironically, Dr. Fan Yane, he was an NLD MP who was imprisoned at the time and was very sick. And I can remember her sitting on the sofa in my office, looking absolutely terrified at me and sort of clutching her handbag. And I said, yeah, now go back, tell that to your brother-in-law, saying that if you did or not. But you know, I thought we did need to distinguish between what they did to people and the approach that the UK government did from a, you know, from a human rights perspective.
If it's not for the punishment, what's the motivation behind putting sanctions on people?
So if you look at the EU wording, it's all around trying to prevent human rights abuses and stimulate reform. And I think that can take a wide range of approaches. So, for example, if you are saying that an individual is perpetuating human rights abuses, whether, you know, it's a military person as in their role, or whether it's someone who's selling arms or whatever, and that by putting them on a sanctions list, that will lead them to change their behavior, then you're preventing future abuses and ultimately taking them off that list. So that is the overall approach. I mean, the US has a slightly different approach in that they've got this sort of executive order that Myanmar is, you know, a threat to the United States of America and so on. But talking about what the EU and the UK are trying to do, that's the underlying purpose of it. But I think although governments have made it this as the goal, I think it's perceived by many people as punishment. And so that's, I think, why there's been this sort of reaction, for example, when people have been taken off the list, a feeling, well, you know, they should never be forgiven, they should never be taken off, whatever it is that they've done. But no, it is meant to be preventative. Whether it works or not, I think, is another question. What I saw over time, particularly going back in 2013 and setting up Myanmar Centre for Responsible Business and trying to meet a lot of these large companies and their owners, including some who'd been on the sanctions list, was that for some, it was very much a never again. And they were extremely keen to know exactly what they should be doing to, you know, rehabilitate their name in terms of, you know, good corporate governance, transparency, what they should avoid doing, all of that kind of thing. There were some who just couldn't be bothered to speak to me. So I don't know what conclusions I should draw from that. But I think overall, definitely, it has had some impact on individuals in terms of their future behavior. What I'm not convinced it has is had any impact on the wider developments in Myanmar. I think that was much more finding its own kind of natural course over time, plus what often people say is that general feeling that the Tatmadaw had that the West was out of contact for them and they were becoming too dependent on China. Now, you could argue that is partially a impact of sanctions, but I think not so much these individual targeted sanctions. I think that's a wider question. So, I mean, overall, I would say that the debate on sanctions and do they work is very much a live one, not just for Myanmar, but more generally. You know, you see it for Russia right now, and you also see it in that whole argument. Basically, I would say almost all of the global South believe that sanctions are a bad thing. They believe that they're neo-colonial. And certainly also when you see certain application of sanctions, I mean, most recently, the US government putting Francesca Albanese, who's the special rapporteur for Palestine, on the same sanctions list that they put people on, you know, from Myanmar. You know, that sort of begs the question, what is it really being used for? Is it more of a punishment beating in the case of the US approach? But yeah, from the EU approach, the aim was to try to prevent human rights harms and encourage reform.
Yeah, your point about reaction from people when they see individuals taking off the sanction list, it's almost like a connotation that, oh, they're no longer punished for it. Although I know that a lot of the rules is not for punishment. And recently, you may have seen that the Eric Ferrari, the lawyer in the law firm behind helping the individuals be delisted from the U.S. sanction list. Many Burmese people in either on social media or in some group messages show anger and hurt towards him. And on his public LinkedIn post, he was celebrating the win And some Burmese people commented their anger towards him. And some of them are calling him lobbyists of who are working close to the military. So his actual official profession is a lawyer and a law firm. And some of the people are they right to be mad at him for representing these clients being removed from the sanction list, right? To quote one of the comments, it was, so one of the Burmese person commented on Eric Ferrari's LinkedIn post. He said, quote, complicit in human suffering, end quote. So by helping his clients get off the sanction list, is that a moral contradiction that people should be angry about?
I think there are two issues here. The first is that everybody has the right to a lawyer. And, you know, the rule of law and the ability to seek remedy when you're put on a list is an incredibly important part of human rights. And so what Ferrari is doing is helping with that, helping the individual people who are put on the sanctions list. And then the second is going to be the actual content of that listing. And, you know, you don't go on a sanctions list forever. You are able to appeal it if the information is wrong. You're able to appeal it if circumstances change, including the fact that, you know, you change behavior. So, you know, my assumption is that in his appeals or petitions and likewise for the others, because I believe he was supporting two petitioners, individuals plus a company. And there would have been other lawyers, I guess, working for the other two people who got taken off the list. I assume that their lawyers were able to demonstrate that to OFAC's satisfaction. Now, that is fair. And indeed, there's been quite a lot of human rights lawyers writing on the importance of due process within the sanctions system. You know, it shouldn't just be a subjective decision, you know, taken by, you know, a bunch of EU ministers who in turn are, you know, listening to some EU ambassadors or whoever who may not be, as I've already explained, fully aware of all the information. I think it's also quite interesting that in the case of the two who were taken off the list, and this was Jonathan Chulthaung and Tin Lap Min for supposed connections with MEHL, that in neither case, so Myanmar Economic Holdings Limited, UBIN, in neither case were those cases taken up by the EU or the UK and put on the list themselves, which inherently to me suggests that they weren't that convinced by the evidence in the first place. So I think that probably is partly what lies behind the recent decisions. But to come back to the point about being angry about the lawyer, you know, people are angry. People are probably going to be angry with just what I'm saying here. But I think, you know, it is an essential part of human rights that people should have the right to defence, and they should have the right to, you know, submit evidence and get a fair hearing.
Yeah, out of the four individuals who were removed from the US sanction list, I think Online U and Sedai Al are still on UK and EU and other countries' sanction list as well. So, you know, I mean, usually, or like what I've seen from before, US is a superpower country and sometimes other countries follow suit. But is there a coordination or, I mean,
I know
is
UK? There has been more attempts to coordinate over the years, and including particularly after the coup. So my assumption is that the UK and the EU will be getting in touch with OFAC about mm-hmm. the two of them still on their lists and seeking further information. Or maybe those people are also putting appeals into the UK and the EU. I don't know about that. But yeah, there is an attempt to coordinate it. I mean, the fact is that if you go on one list, it to some extent has an impact across the board, because you then will go on to all of the sort of global sanctions databases and things like Refinitiv, so that anybody running due diligence on you, if they find you're on one list, it's as good as being on three or four. But in these particular cases where there's now that's inconsistency, I would expect the UK and the EU to be looking to see, you know, what were the reasons why they were taken off the US list.
Yeah, we're talking about sanctions, but can you explain more about different types of sanction? Is targeted, blanket, or is it all like, so what can you not do once you're sanctioned? Can you not travel? Can you not use your credit card? Or like what part of it is? Like, because I think generally what we understand is probably not the whole version of what sanctions are in a way.
So when we're talking sanctions, I mean, there are the sanctions that go beyond the individual and the company. So there you have things like bans on arms sales, bans on dual use equipment. Those, in a way, are perhaps the most targeted, although even those can have unforeseen or unfortunate effects. Like, for example, we saw with the ban on surveillance equipment, which really contributed to Telenor's exit. But the coup was a major part of that as well. But it put Telenor in a difficult position pre-coup as well, when the NLD government was telling them they had to apply surveillance equipment, which was illegal under EU law. And it would have required them to seek an exemption from the EU, or actually from the Norwegian government, because Norway sort of follows the same thing. So you've got the those sort of arms embargoes, which are, I think, in a way, the most clear. Then you have the sort of sanctions that relate to bans on technical assistance, economic assistance, particularly government to government. The World Bank is currently, I think, still maintaining an Article 70 procedure on Myanmar, even after 4 years, where they suspend that sort of assistance. And most other governments have suspended it as well, in terms of the things they were doing previously with the NLD government. Humanitarian assistance mostly continues. And obviously here I'm not talking about the US and USAID, which is a whole different ballgame. And then you've got those kind of political sanctions around visits and recognition, which again, in a way, are targeted and don't impact on individuals. And then finally, you've got the sort of broader economic sanctions as well, like removing tariff preferences, or indeed, as we've sort of seen with the US, although again, that's part of a much bigger thing, raising tariffs. But if we're going back down to the assets freeze and the visa bans, it has an impact on people's ability to be banked in many countries, many jurisdictions, because it will tie in to also the work of the Financial Action Task Force, the FATF blacklisting. So individuals will find it very difficult to open a bank account. They won't get visas for the countries which are sanctioning them. That doesn't mean they won't get visas for other countries. They will still have their Myanmar passport with them. But what it also unfortunately means in Myanmar's case is that because everybody has such similar names, it actually has a much wider knock-on effect. And so you have found for many years, people, for example, in the UK, Myanmar students and so on, who have kind of common names like Than Thuyn, having to try and explain that they are not Brigadier General Than Thuyn. And in fact, my own personal experience of this was my 70-year-old mother-in-law was detained briefly at Heathrow Airport because they thought that she was Lieutenant General Aung Chi, even though her name is Dorshi Aung. So luckily that didn't last too long, but I mean, it was nonetheless evidence of how this can, the longer the list is, the more non-targeted people can be impacted. And then on top of that, where you've got businesses which are owned by, quote, cronies who are on these lists, there will be an impact, obviously, on their employees. Now, in some cases, if they're kind of running a sort of three-person, gems business, it's not going to make much difference. But if they've got a bank that's employing 10,000 people and that starts to have problems in operating, that has a knock-on impact on people who have nothing to do with the original case for which a person's put on a sanctions list. So they're not completely targeted. And they do have broader effects, which aren't often foreseen, which is why, again, one needs to be very careful and, I would say, limited in terms of how you play this card. And I gave the example earlier on of this slightly ridiculous recourse to the yellow pages of Yangon directory and listing all of the furniture shops. I mean, that was just daft, frankly. As I say, it happened after I left, thank God.
Yeah, so you said it's to consider reform or a change in behavior. And also, in the earlier on, you mentioned the imperfect process of finding people to sanction based on donation, seeing on the newspaper, those things. But if you are a wealthy individual in Myanmar doing business in Myanmar, can you really be free from any association with the military?
I think it's becoming increasingly difficult, but that doesn't mean that one should therefore punish all wealthy individuals, because if you're being forced to, you know, I mean, for example, we're seeing it with the increased number of restrictions means that, and restrictions, I'm talking here about things like import permits and, you know, exchange rates and so on, means that more and more businesses are having to pay facilitation payments. Often, you know, not to, this is not going to Minnan Lying, it's going to, you know, the retired colonel who's in charge of the customs department or whoever it might be. So, but that for me is not a kind of a choice. It's a matter of keeping your business activities and your employees, you know, functioning. So as governance deteriorates, and this is not unique at all to Myanmar, by the way. I mean, you know, the practices in many other countries are the same. So I think one has to distinguish between that and those that actively go out to seek to, for example, you know, sell guns to the military or help them to buy guns, that kind of thing. And so it's a very different type of collaboration. One is involuntary, one is voluntary.
Mm. You said that you met the people that you once recommended to put on a sanction and later remove, right? And then do you actually see a change in behavior? Or like, is there, since the laws and the sanction laws change over time, are people just getting better, navigating through it? Or things are more transparent as they should be? Or what are the different changes that you've seen?
So what I'm talking about here, and I should just be clear, it wasn't me removing them, because by that time I'd long left the embassy and left the foreign ministry. But, you know, those who were taken off in that 2012 period when changes started to occur, what I saw with some of them was a very clear intent to do business differently under a new, at that time, Thein Sein, subsequently Aung San Suu Kyi regime, which was itself saying it was favouring transparency, governance, etc. And often also they had their second generation taking over the business, some of whom had studied overseas, you know, wanted to do things differently as well. So definitely that was true of some, but it wasn't true of others as far as I could see. So I think it very much depends on the individual. And again, that to me is a reflection of that. There was this huge spectrum of types of people that we ended up with on that list of eight or however many it was, both in terms of their background and their business activities. And it's very difficult to generalize. And it's very important, therefore, that they should have the ability to make their case. But definitely, you know, in that period, both after 2012, but also after the coup, I think there have been changes in the way that or that people have, you know, taken specific decisions about, you know, where to go, what to do, you know, whether to participate in whatever it might be, you know, meetings at Naypyidaw, all that kind of thing. There's an awful lot of businesses who are terrified of being called to Naypyidaw to be in meetings. That's definitely, I think, a reflection of the fact that they do not want to risk that sort of, you know, information, for want of a better word, or data being used to put them back on sanctions list, even if they had no desire to be there in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Once you're summoned to Naypyidaw, you kind of have to go. You don't really have a choice, right? Like, if you want to,
it's difficult. It's difficult. Yeah, and it's increasingly difficult when, you know, the Tatmadaw, the SPDC, has always created enough restrictions and enough laws that, you know, they can bang you up for failing to return your library book, or in my case, as they claimed, failing to fill in your permanent change of address form. So we've seen quite a few business people being arrested after the coup, you know, rightly or wrongly. You know, business people are vulnerable, and they're caught between a rock and a hard place on these kind of things. You know, the trips to Russia, all of that kind of thing. You know, a lot of them try to say that they've got dental appointments, or their doctor has told them they're not allowed to travel or whatever. Sometimes they succeed, sometimes not.
Back on the topic of the sanctions, and, you know, so the motivation from the government is to stop further human rights abuse or human rights violations, and also to create reform. And what are, so does it have a side effect on the people that are not intended to be part of it, like the civilians or the lives of the regular daily citizens? Because, I mean, sometimes the entire country is sanctioned, but sometimes only individuals or companies are being sanctioned, but it affects their business. So what is the spillage on that?
Well, as I've already said, I think that there's that unforeseen effect of the fact that so many Myanmar names are the same. But on top of that, nowadays, and this is partly a reflection of the FATF blacklisting more generally of Myanmar, it's very difficult to get a bank account if you're a Myanmar person. Because banks are just generally kind of, you know, it's low value, it's high risk for us. We don't know who you are. We'll just exclude you. So that means all sorts of people, you know, who might be opposition, they might be refugees, they might be students, whatever, you know, whether it's in Singapore, Thailand, UK, and so on, they're impacted by that. So there is a spillover effect. Likewise, you know, where you do have companies who are unable to proceed with perfectly legitimate business partnerships because the owner has been put on a sanctions list, then that has an impact on employees or it has an impact on services. So there are spillover effects, undoubtedly. In a way, some of the cleverer sanctions, I guess, if you really want to be targeted, were that the US certainly previously, before it banned all Myanmar people from traveling to the US, had a kind of shadow list for visa bans. And I think that is more targeted than the financial sanctions, because that really impacts on people's ability to go and study. And so this was applying to a much wider group of people than they published. And it was, as far as I understand, directed at sort of, you know, directors of previous, former, whatever, crony companies, but also relatives of senior military and so on. Whether or not it's objective, I don't know, but at least that doesn't have a spillover effect, providing the embassy has got its information right, of course. So you know, people were saying they were having difficulty getting US visas. The US embassy was, you know, requiring people to fill in huge kind of family trees. Again, a bit like the Myanmar embassy whenever you go and try and apply for something. But yeah, that's more targeted than the assets freeze type of a sanction, which does have a much wider effect on business activity, including perfectly legitimate business activity, particularly when the subject of the sanction is perhaps, you know, mistakenly targeted.
Your point on the spillover effect of Myanmar nationals and overseas having a difficult time getting bank accounts. In my experience, because I had a Burmese passport, and you know, like when you look at the Burmese passport, there's always some kind of ink mark that's not so perfect. And then there's a lot of handwritten things instead of typed. We don't have a chip in it, cannot scan it. So every time I go to the airport, I cannot scan it. And also when I return to America from a smaller airport, like, I mean, big airports like Washington, Dallas airport, it's fine. They have seen these kind of passports before. But if I go to airports like Baltimore, much smaller, they have not seen it enough. Every time, it's been three times, I have been randomly selected to further proceed. So, you know, the perks of having a Burmese passport.
Oh, very limited. But yeah, I mean, obviously that is the fault of the Myanmar passport issuing office, but you're not the only person that has come across those challenges at borders, certainly. But yeah, that's not a sanctions issue, but certainly the fact that you are a Myanmar citizen is going to have an impact on your ability to get a bank account, regardless of whether your passport is in a pristine form.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So with that, like US and Myanmar relations has taken into some kind of different progression since the new Trump administration. I know that with this recent July 24 removal of individuals from the sanction list is unrelated to U.S. policy change. But other things leading up to that, the progression of, you know, the correspondence between President Trump and Senior General Myint Lyn in a letter regarding tariff and also different flattery language in there. And also the United States stance towards international humanitarian aids angle as well, right? The gutting of the USAID, United States AIDS for International Development, has also hurt the humanitarian assistance in Myanmar directly. And also the DEI scholarship, Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Scholarship, which was supporting Burmese students abroad. It's about $45 million worth of it. And then now the students are stranded in studies that they have started. And also the shutting down of Voice of America and RFA, Radio Free Asia Burmese Language Services. So with that shutting down of media, there's kind of like a media blackout right now. And while the lacking of independent media in the country of Myanmar, this has caused a lot of ruckus towards it. These are all, I mean, to me, seeing a change of heart or like the indication that might see less interest in Myanmar or like a scaling back into this America first kind of outlook, more internal looking. But, you know, but also recently the news article came out about Trump administration's sudden interest in Myanmar because of rare earth. With this progression of things, I want to know, you know, what do you think about U.S., the future of U.S. policy in Myanmar, and also from leading from there, seeing like the global outlook on Myanmar, also with UK and EU as well?
Yeah, I mean, what you described is a reflection of U.S. foreign policy being pretty chaotic, but this isn't Myanmar specific. And I think that one shouldn't read anything about Myanmar into any of this. These are problems which are, or changes which are applicable across the globe to US policy. And it's quite clear there is a very strong withdrawal from a US that was committed to supporting human rights and democracy in countries across the world. I mean, on top of what you've said, the US has left the UN Human Rights Council. Therefore, it's not going to be involved in mandates for any future UN Special Rapporteur. Tom Andrews' job, he's a US citizen, his job comes up for replacement soon. US has left the body that appoints him. I mean, likewise, UNESCO, World Health Organization, they've quit all of these things. So all of this has an impact globally. State Department's closed down the Department of Human Rights and Labour. So, you know, in addition to, as you've said, all of the support that was being given to NGOs working on freedom of expression, media organisations, and so on. So it's not Myanmar specific. And frankly, I don't think Myanmar is of any importance to the Trump administration whatsoever. What we saw with that exchange of letters, that was purely mail merge. You know, Trump was just taking his Sharpie to all the letters put in front of him by people within his office who clearly didn't understand that the US still calls Myanmar Burma, apart from anything else. Yeah. So one shouldn't read too much into that. Equally, one shouldn't read anything into, and I wouldn't describe this as, you know, Trump having an interest in rare earths. I think it's much more that what we've seen as a reaction to this sense that the US doesn't care about Myanmar anymore is people are going, but what about China threats? You know, what about rare earths? In exactly the same way that this was done for Ukraine. I don't think that there's a meaningful strategy to be developed around rare earths in Myanmar from a perspective of re-engaging the US in things that will actually be helpful. In fact, I think, you know, almost the opposite. So I wouldn't read much into the fact that there's been quite a lot of media reporting, but a lot of it pretty half-assed on this topic. But I do think it is a really, really sad challenge for those who are, you know, sick, poor refugees seeking to keep the free media going in Myanmar. I think that the US is letting them down massively, and I'm not quite sure what one can do about that. But I hope that, you know, Myanmar people of Myanmar origin in the US that voted for Trump are reflecting on the impacts of that.
Yeah.
And I suppose the next test of all of this is these three Burma bills, which have gone through the House of Representatives Financial Services Committee, but they haven't gone through the House or the Senate yet, but they will ultimately go on to the president. Now, it will be interesting to see what the debates around those are, what the response of the White House is on that. But without money, I don't think that there is a lot of help that the US is going to be giving to the people of Myanmar anytime soon.
Yeah, like I see some op-ed saying that US is giving mixed signals, mixed feelings towards Myanmar, because on one hand, some bills are getting passed, but not entirely. They have not become laws yet. Congress is still working on some kind of passing the bills to protect human rights and democracy in Myanmar. But on the other hand, the D word in Washington, D.C., democracy, it's not really the most popular word right now, I don't think.
And I think on top of that, you know, if you've got an administration which has ripped apart the delivery mechanisms for this aid, even if Congress passes it, what's that going to mean in practice? Mm. You know, the closure of USAID, or the effect, the merging of USAID and the stripping out of human rights from the State Department and so on. You know, the bills may be almost meaningless without the backup of an administration that can implement them. Anyway, I think we can't at this stage tell, but one thing it does leave us thinking, and it's not, I mean, although, you know, the Trump administration is a lure unto itself, but we should look more generally at the fact that the world is a very different place now to what it was in 2012, both in terms of global availability of funds for development assistance and humanitarian assistance, the sort of shift in power balances, a global commitment around human rights and rule of law and support for UN agencies and so on. So I think that, you know, even if we do get to a point where there is a transition to, a more democratic government, there will not be the same help for Myanmar that there was in 2012, sadly. On top of that, of course, you know, the pulling factor that Aung San Suu Kyi played in that time is not going to be there anymore.
Yeah. With the election coming up in Myanmar, that might happen sooner rather than later, or I guess towards the end of 2025. With the U.S. policy change too, do you think, is there any going to be, it's a recognition, or like what is looming in the future of Myanmar?
I don't think I can predict that. I don't think any of us can predict it. But all I'm saying is that whatever the outcome, what I think is going to be most important is what countries in the region do to react. And, you know, anybody's interested in Myanmar's future needs to be thinking about, you know, what it is that China, India, Japan, Korea and ASEAN are going to do. The US reaction, I think, is both unpredictable and possibly also irrelevant.
Mm-hmm. And with the removal of these recent removal of sanctions, right, it is just this case that these sanctions are removed. Do you think more of those will come on, or is it not going to change at all? Like you mentioned before that it is technical, not political. Can we speculate anything from it, or is it just at this time this happened?
I don't know, because I think this is entirely depends on whether others on the sanction list seek to petition. And maybe there are petitions already there. Maybe there are petitions which have been rejected. We just don't know that. But that will be very much dependent on those on the list doing that. I think another big issue is whether or not the 40% tariff stays for the US's approach to exports from Myanmar. But equally, you know, within the EU, which is a much more important market for apparel, I think there is a lot of concern around recent arrests of labour rights activists, Myo Myo A being an example of that. And that could ultimately lead to impacts on the EU as an export market for apparel, which is not something the EU particularly wants to do because it hurts workers. But if the SAC is showing, or whatever it calls itself now, is showing that it is not possible for labour rights activists to work on the ground, and Myo Myo A is not the only person who has been recently detained, then that will beg the question as to whether or not it is possible to source garments responsibly into the EU market from Myanmar. And the EU itself has a number of regulations, including the forced labour regulation, which is coming into effect. And that will definitely be highlighting Myanmar as one of the countries of particular concern, not least because of the ILO's Commission of Inquiry. So there's a lot potentially still going on there. The real challenge will be for those countries involved to implement policy in a way which doesn't hurt the very poorest.
Mm. Yeah, we talk a lot about sanction and business. And, you know, as we come to a close, I want to ask you, as your role as a director of Myanmar Center of Responsible Business, MCRB, what defines a responsible business in a complex country like Myanmar?
Well, firstly, I mean, I should say that, you know, we basically closed down Myanmar Center for Responsible Business. We're in the process of winding it up at the UK end. The work that we did over the 10 or more years is going to remain online, and I hope it will be of use for future administrations, not least because an awful lot of what defines responsible business is defined by the legislative framework in which businesses have to work. And we've talked here a lot about things like crony businesses. Now, the way to avoid cronies is to have transparent procurement policies, to have freedom of expression, free media, etc., in the country where business is done. It's around anti-corruption laws that actually work. So we did a lot of work on that over 10 years or more. That's still available on our website, but there definitely needs to be work done to improve the legislative framework, particularly if that's going to be something that in the future becomes part of a bottom-up federal legislative framework. One of the things that concerns me when I hear that, the bottom-up federalism, I think there's some positives, but if you have a very fragmented legal system, you'll almost certainly have greater opportunity for local cronyism, not least because you don't have the capacity at local level of things like, functioning courts or anti-corruption commissions to prevent local corruption from happening. So I think, as debates on this continue, I hope to take place, that sort of legislative framework that ensures and supports responsible business is something we really need to look at, because too often you get people thinking this is only about the companies and what the companies do. But you're often having companies who are operating in a framework which prevents them from being responsible. Probably the perfect example of that will be everything related to the regulation of data privacy, cybersecurity, surveillance, and so on, where the companies themselves didn't want to put surveillance equipment onto their networks, but were being told by the NLD government that they had to. And therefore, what one needs is the human rights safeguards in the law that ensure that at least there will be proper rule of law and due process around the operation of that equipment. So those are the kind of things which I think are a big challenge for the future, assuming we get to that point. We're a long way from it at the moment, unfortunately. But I hope that the work that we did over the 10 years prior to the coup will be useful for the future. And then there's one other point I want to add, which I sort of alluded to earlier, which is I do think, Insight Myanmar as a podcast has been very much engaged on trying to help people understand Buddhism, insight meditation, faith. And I do think that some of the issues that we've discussed here about the anger that people feel towards businesses, people should reflect on that from the perspective of, different faiths. You've got the Dhammapada talking about how, hatred can only be appeased by non-hatred, not by further hatred. But equally, in Christianity, you have a sort of, do as you would be done by, treat others as you would have yourself be treated. Because I feel that the huge anger and polarization that has quite understandably been caused is not going to help us to get forward to a world which is has been more peaceful, more prosperous, more transparent.
We talk a lot about the sanctions and the nature of it, but I also want to ask you, since you've been in the Myanmar sphere for a really long time and seen a lot of observation in terms of sanction angles as well, I want to ask, what is the good, bad, and ugly bits of the sanction, the consequences, and what it does?
Yeah, because I have very mixed feelings about sanctions, and particularly when we're talking about these targeted sanctions. So I think the good, I mean, I think the areas where they can work, where they have worked, the first one I would say is the fact that UBINE, MEHL and Myanmar Economic Corporation, being on sanctions lists has made them pretty much untouchable. And I think that's a good thing because for the longer term, it should make it difficult for them or for any military-owned company to play a role in the economy. I don't think that that's the job of a military. They shouldn't be running businesses. It's distortive. It makes things opaque. And I think that, you know, companies like Kirin, for example, the Japanese beer company, who went in 2015 and got into a joint venture with MEHL, neither they nor any other company would ever do that again, having seen what's happened and having seen the impact of sanctions on those companies. So I think that's a positive. I do think, as I said earlier, that it has led individuals to change their behaviour, certain individuals, maybe not all. But I don't think it's been a change to systemic behaviour. So whether that's a good or a bad thing, I don't think it's had that overall aim that, you know, the EU and others wanted. Another bad element is, unfortunately, it has to some extent reversed transparency, because you've seen both companies then reluctant to do the things we were encouraging them to do about being transparent about their governance, about their beneficial ownership, and so on. You've had the company's registry has taken down a lot of the information that it had started to put up on those kind of issues. The Extractive Industry Transparency Initiative was something which was promoting it. All of that's gone backwards. And I think a lot of that is because, you know, the people or the institutions concerned have been worried that the more information that's out there, the more potentially vulnerable they are to being sanctioned is. So I think that's a shame. And then the other thing which I feel is bad is that this lack of information has created a whole kind of opportunity around, frankly, unethical journalism, sometimes not even just poor quality or misinformed journalism, but deliberate misinformation. And that can be either sort of business rivals trying to encourage reporting of information which is going to hurt their rivals and get them put on sanctions list. But I've also seen it the other way round, of journalists saying, well, we'll report this story on you unless you give us some other information, some other dirt on someone else. And I think all of that is a very unhealthy behaviour for the media sphere. And I've seen it also in terms of companies who've gone out to try to correct what was clearly wrong information and being told, well, we're not going to remove that. Well, we might think about it if you bought advertising with us or if you made a donation to us. You can see that very clearly, for example, with if you look up Peace Myanmar Group on Wikipedia, where they were still dealing kind of 10, 20 years afterwards with some reporting from Asia Week and Irrawaddy that they were a WA company. And in the end, what they did to address that was a sort of statement that explained what their origins were, which is now featured also in the Wikipedia page. But these kind of things, they all create these sort of, you know, potential opportunities for distortion or even extortion, which I think are really, really unhelpful, frankly. And so that's, for me, another side effect of sanctions, which is one reason why I have very mixed feelings about them.
And know for a lot of podcast listeners, as soon as the fundraising requests start up, you just kind of zone out till it's over, skip ahead. But if you're taking the time to listen to our full podcast, can I ask that you also take a moment to listen to our spiel? Because the reality is, creating this content takes immense effort and resources. And if you make a donation or contribution, you'll not just be helping to keep this podcast going, you'll also be standing in solidarity with the people of Myanmar during one of the most challenging periods in their history. Please take a look at insightmyanmar.org/donation for more details.
Yarananda, 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 Yarananda,